I want to talk today about the question whether history has made progress, whether the question of progress can be applied to historical studies. There are academic disciplines to which it obviously applies, and others to which one would say, or at least I would say, that it does not. In a way, the distinction is visible in our libraries. The natural sciences, in which progress is not seriously to be doubted by any rational observer, in the natural sciences, books are hardly ever used anymore, except for the purpose of elementary teaching and the occasional short-lived synthesis of their field, because in these sciences, the rate of obsolescence is proportionate to the rate of progress in the subject. In our lifetime, this progress has been prodigious. There are no classics to be read in the natural sciences, except with a sense of pietas towards great predecessors or those with an interest in the history of science. What survives of Newton or Clerk Maxwell or Mendel has been absorbed into the wider and demonstrably less inadequate understanding of the physical universe. And conversely, the average mediocre graduate student in physics has a better understanding of this universe today than Newton had. Historians and other analysts of the process and development of the natural sciences know that this process is far from linear, but we cannot doubt its existence. On the other hand, consider literary criticism, which is the only form of the study of the creative arts which is habitually practiced in British universities, most universities. Progress is neither demonstrable nor plausible in this field, except in the relatively trivial forms of erudition and technical sophistication. 20th century literature is not better than 17th century literature, nor is the criticism of an 18th century critic, like Dr. Johnson, for instance, worse than that of a 20th century critic, like, say, Roland Barthes. They are different. No doubt, the great bulk of academic or other critical writings drop out of sight, except for PhD students, but insofar as they survive, it is not because they are more recent and have therefore replaced their predecessors, but only insofar as they are by authors who, for one reason or another, are considered to be particularly perspicacious and particularly interesting. Of course, there is a part of literary studies which is simply a specialized form of history. History of literature, history of literary criticism, but that isn't what I'm talking about. I'm talking of literary criticism as such. And for that reason, in literary departments, books are read and books are generated. There are other disciplines to which the concept of progress seems equally difficult to apply, at least globally. For instance, philosophy and law. Plato was not rendered obsolete by Descartes. Descartes was not rendered obsolete by Kant, nor Kant by Hegel. Nor can we detect a process of accumulating wisdom which absorbs and assimilates later work, which then turns out to be more permanently true than the earlier work. Indeed, we very often observe merely the continuation or revival of old debates, sometimes of ancient debates, in contemporary terms. It's a bit like those theatrical producers who produced Shakespeare in 1920s costume or transposed into the form of the modern mafia and make their reputation that way. It's still the same Shakespeare done in a different way. This isn't a criticism of such disciplines. It's merely to say that they are different from, say, the sciences. It's not a criticism of chess to say that whereas in athletics we can say that achievements have become better over the years, people run faster today than they did 50 years ago, we cannot say the average chess player today is a cleverer man than they were in the days of Morphy and Steinitz. Now, history clearly has something in common with this second kind of subject, as is demonstrated by the fact that historians not only write books, but above all read books, including very old ones. On the other hand, historians do become obsolete, though probably at a rather slower rate than scientists. We don't read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in the way we still read Kant or Rousseau for their relevance to our own problems. We read him with enormous admiration, no doubt, for his learning, not to learn about the Roman Empire, but for his literary merits. That's to say, most practicing historians don't read him at all, except in their spare time, in their leisure hours. If we read the works of older historians at all, it is either because they have provided us with some permanent corpus of historical raw material, such as an unsuperseded edition of medieval chronicles, the Monumenta Historia Germanica, for instance, or because they happen to have been interested in a topic which has not attracted subsequent work. For one reason or another, it happens that sometimes we are interested in a field which has been neglected for a century, and then people who have written a book about it a century ago can still be read, but not because they are old historians, but because for the purpose of this work they are new historians. Nobody else has worked on it. This, if I may say so, is the economic basis for the reprint industry. Many old classics are reprinted, or were reprinted in the 60s and 70s, for that reason. Of course, the very fact that an ancient book may surface again more than a century after its original purposes raises, at least by implication, precisely the question I'm asking you. Can we speak of progress in history? And if so, what is its character? It's obviously not progress in the sense that historians have become more learned or more intelligent. They have certainly not become more learned. There is nothing like the monument of erudition which we find in 19th century German historians, for instance, or many others. Probably most of us today are less learned because we have less training in memory. The computer in fact replaces it. I mean, there was, for instance, an old expert on Greek pottery in England. These was in the days before computers or anything else, who held in his mind all the shapes, who had memorized virtually every Greek vase there was, and based his classification on this memory. None of us would bother to do it today, and probably none of us could. I'm not sure whether historians become more intelligent, though there is a case to be made here. Over the past century or two, history has not been a discipline which required great intellectual powers. I have, at one stage of my career, had occasion to have close contact with a discipline which does call for considerable brain power, which is when I was associated with the economics faculty in Cambridge at the time when Cambridge was the main centre of economics. And I can tell you, I've never forgotten the salutary but depressing experience of spending a great deal of time with a lot of people who are very, very clever, probably cleverer than oneself. You see? Well, now, I don't say that historians 50 years ago did not include people of equal intelligence, although it was and it still is possible for a person to make a fine contribution to history or a great reputation, the two are not the same, armed with little more than a capacity for very hard work and perhaps some detective-like ingenuity. It may even be argued that the very hostility to theory and generalization which characterized so much orthodox academic history in the long period when it was dominated by the tradition of the great Ranke encouraged people who were intellectually unadventurous, and these were also often people who were intellectually undemanding. On the other hand, there have been countries and periods in which history attracted the very opposite type of minds. For instance, in France during the 1930s, when it was quite clear that some very clever people went into history, and history became, in some ways, the central discipline of the social sciences. So we cannot necessarily say that we've become cleverer, and we probably have become less learned. But that is a comparatively trivial point. In what significant way can one say that history has progressed? There's no obvious answer to this question because there is no agreement among historians about what they're trying to do, or for that matter, about what their subject matter is, because everything in the past is their subject matter. While I have been a historian, the subject matter of history has prolonged by several decades, and so there is no way of arguing that anybody investigating any part of the past is not a historian. Marxist historians, economic historians, others can agree as to what the subject is, but historians without qualifications cannot. Now, this actually is what provides so strong and effective a set of fortifications behind which historical conservatives and those who reject history can make their stand, because they can say what we do is just as much history as what you do, or alternatively they can say that none of this is history. And it also guarantees that it is, they make their defensive stand, but it will never be their last stand. You can go on arguing against rational or scientific history forever. In fact, it is quite true. It is impossible for me to say that even the most mindless antiquarian is not a historian and is not making a contribution to history. It may seem, what he does may seem trivial now, but it may turn out to be important. For instance, a great deal of historical demography, which is a very mature subject, one of the most mature subjects we have today, a great deal of historical demography rests on material originally collected by genealogists. Genealogists collected it either for reasons of snobbery, to have family trees of their families, or, as in the case of the Mormons in Salt Lake City, who have the greatest collection of genealogical material, they collected it for obscure theological reasons, but the fact is, they collected it, the material is there now, and modern historic demographers use it and discover that actually it can serve for other purposes than the ones for which it was originally collected. So it is very difficult, in a sense, to exclude any activity that may turn out to be important. But I think there's a way of avoiding such debates and pointless debates, and that is to see what actually has been happening in historical research over the past few generations, and to indicate whether there is a systematic tendency in what has been happening. This doesn't prove progress, but it may well show that there's more to this discipline than a sort of academic canoe bobbing up and down on the waves of personal taste, of current politics or ideology, or even merely of fashion. Let us go back a century to the middle 1890s, which forms so important a turning point in the history of the modern natural sciences. History as a respectable academic subject had been firmly established. The archives were ordered. The standard journals which still exist had been founded fairly recently. The Historische Zeitschrift, the Revue Historique, the English Historical Review, the American Historical Review, and so on. All of them children of the last quarter of the 19th century. The nature of the discipline seemed clear. The great historians were formidable figures in public life, which means in England they included bishops and peers, you see. And methods of this new science were expounded by Seigneur Boss and Langlois in France and others. Lord Acton in Cambridge even thought the time had come for a definitive modern history in which one chapter would be written by a German, another by a Frenchman, a third by an Italian, and you could not tell the difference because permanent truth had been arrived at. We now know that this was not so. Less than 50 years after Lord Acton's Cambridge Modern History, the Cambridge Modern History had to be completely scrapped and completely rewritten. Yet, even at this moment of triumph, there were skeptics. The challenge essentially concerned the nature of the subject matter of history. At that stage, it was overwhelmingly narrative and descriptive, political and institutional, the kind of old-fashioned school history about battles and treaties and conquests and cabinets. The question was whether this was an adequate subject and whether one could generalize about history or not. And essentially, this challenge came from the social sciences and from outsiders who believed that history should be a special form of social science. Whether following Auguste Comte or following Karl Marx or some other methodology. Now, the bulk of established professional historians rejected this challenge totally. The matter was argued out with surprising bitterness in the middle 1890s in Germany in connection with the challenge of one historical heretic who now seems to us not very heterodox, Karl Lamprecht. History, said the orthodox, was essentially descriptive. People, events, situations were so different that no generalizations about society were possible. There could, therefore, be no, as it used to be called, historic laws. Now, in fact, two interrelated matters are at issue here. The first was the actual selection from the past which made up the essential subject matter of Orthodox history. This dealt primarily with politics and in the modern period, foreign policies of nation states. It concentrated on great, the jargon today would say decision makers, and while it recognized that other aspects of the past might be investigated, it tended to leave these to sub-disciplines like the history of culture or economic history and the relations of these with proper history were left vaguely, left obscure. People talked generally about a zeitgeist, a spirit of the times, but this didn't actually explain anything very much. In short, the selection was both narrow and, even then, it was clear politically it was very biased. But secondly, what was at issue was also the rejection of any attempt to bring the various aspects of the past into a systematic, structural, or causal relation to one another, especially any attempt to derive politics from economic and social factors, and above all, any models of the evolutionary development of societies. Although, as a matter of fact, the practice, even of Ranke and the other historians, implied a model of the development of human societies, but they rejected bringing this into the open. They rejected any model of historical, of stages of historical development. Georg von Below, in the Historische Zeitschrift, 1898, said that such things might be popular among natural scientists, among philosophers, among economists, among jurists, even among some theologians, but they had no place in history. Now, this view was in fact a late or mid-19th century reaction against the earlier developments of history, namely in the 18th century. However, that is not my concern here. In any case, the 18th century historians and historically minded economists and sociologists, there were important schools of these in Scotland and also in Göttingen, these were actually technically not yet able to solve their problems of creating a genuinely comprehensive history which would both establish the general regularities of social organization and social change, and which should bring them into relations with the institutions and events of politics, and which should also take account of the uniqueness of events and the peculiarities of conscious human decision. My point is that the extreme position which represented the Rankean orthodoxy was dominant in Western universities, and this was being challenged not only on ideological grounds, but because of its narrowness and inadequacy. And even at the time of its triumph, it was already fighting a rearguard action, although from strongly entrenched fortifications of academic faculties. It was challenged ideologically, and I stress this point, because orthodoxy itself preferred to regard the challenge as an ideological, and more specifically, as a socialist and even Marxist challenge. The Historische Zeitschrift, for instance, insisted in this debate, which I'm trying to summarize, that what they were against was the collectivist conception of history as against the individualist conception of history. They were against a materialist conception of history, and everybody knows what a materialist conception of history meant. But, in fact, that wasn't, I think, the issue. The revolt against orthodoxy was not confined to any single ideology. It included both followers of Marx and Kant, as well as people like Lamprecht, who were politically and ideologically by no means rebellious. It included the followers of Max Weber and Durkheim. In France, for instance, the rebellion against historical orthodoxy, the fight against the so-called histoire événementielle, you know, against Langlois and Seigneur Boss, owes very little indeed to Marxism for historical reasons which we needn't go into. in Britain for historical reasons, which are also irrelevant to this talk, the challenge from the Marxists was more important, but it was not essentially a critique from a particular ideological point of view. And orthodoxy was already on the retreat well before 1914, even though it was effectively protected. For instance, the last pre-war edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica already observed that from the mid-19th century on, there had been a growing attempt systematically to substitute a materialist for an idealist framework of historical analysis. And they said that this had led to the rise of what they called economic and sociological history. Now, this tendency has indeed continued to progress. If I say it was general, it's not because I wish to minimize the specific influence of Marx and Marxism on it. No, what I'm trying to do is rather to show that historiography was moving in a particular direction over a period of several generations, irrespective of the ideologies of its practitioners, and what is more significant, against the powerful opposition of the entrenched academic establishments. Before 1914, largely from people outside history, from economists who in some countries, like Germany, had a very strong historical bias, from sociologists, in one case, France, from geographers. La géographie humaine was one way of introducing a broader basis into history. Even from lawyers. For instance, I mean, one of the greatest, in my view, the greatest English historian was Maitland, who was actually a jurist who discussed medieval history. If we think, for instance, of the crucial and much discussed question of the relation between society and religion, or more specifically, between Protestantism and the rise of capitalism, this is a big historical debate which has been going on for the whole of the 20th century. The original classic texts, well, leaving aside Karl Marx, because actually Karl Marx only wrote a few sentences on this subject from which all this debate has sprung. They were enormously influential sentences in Capital and elsewhere, but he never wrote detail. But the fuller texts, which occurred mostly at the first decade of the 20th century, came from Max Weber, who was a sociologist, from Troeltsch, who was a theologian, you see. Later, orthodoxy from within the historical profession itself. In France, the famous Annales, originally and characteristically called Annales d'histoire économique et sociale, attacked the fortress of the Sorbonne from the provincial base of Strasbourg. In Britain, the journal Past and Present was again an outsider journal, but of professional historians. And both these journals, at different times, established themselves really quite rapidly as important journals because, as I say, people were prepared to follow these critiques. In West Germany, the first and perhaps the last bastion of tradition, it was challenged in the 1960s by radical opponents of German nationalism, and by people who deliberately sought their information in the one or two historians of the Weimar period who could be considered as Democrats and Republicans. And the main emphasis of the group was once again on explaining politics in terms of social and economic developments, the so-called historische Sozialwissenschaft, the historical social science of the Bielefeld school, of Weber and Kocka and the others. So we find the same tendencies throughout. So there is no doubt about the way the thing goes. You've merely to compare a standard interwar textbook of European history with a standard modern textbook, even when written by very conservative historians. The difference is quite extraordinary. The elements of economic and social treatment is far greater than ever before. So what we've seen essentially over the 20th century is precisely what the orthodox historians of the 1890s rejected completely, namely a rapprochement between history and the social sciences. Now, of course, history cannot be more than partly subsumed under the heading of the social sciences, or perhaps of any science. But this shouldn't prevent some historians from concentrating on problems which could and are tackled by, say, historically minded demographers or economists. Of course, the rapprochement is not only from one side. If the historians have increasingly looked to various social sciences for methods and explanatory models, social sciences have increasingly tried to historicize themselves and to look more to historians. Indeed, one might even go further, that one of the things that has been happening in the 20th century is an extraordinary historization even of the natural sciences. Fields have been developed in the natural sciences which by the old positivist standards could not be sciences because the method of experiment is inapplicable to them. Virtually all evolutionary sciences of this kind, cosmologies of this kind, geology of this kind, paleontology, all these are in fact parts of the natural sciences which could not apply the classical methodology worked out for sciences in the ahistoric period when physics and chemistry predominated. And indeed, it seems to me, the historization of science goes side by side with, you might say, the rapprochement between history and disciplines which are which aim at the scientific generalization about societies, such as, for instance, demography, ecology, I mean, any number of others. Now, of course, the professors of the late 19th century were quite right to reject the evolutionary schemata, the explanatory models of contemporary social science, as simple-minded and unrealistic. And indeed, many of these models today can still be rejected as simple-minded and unrealistic. For instance, the famous model of modernization, which was dominated the social sciences, largely under American influences in the 50s and 60s, which is actually greatly less sophisticated than what most historians did. Nevertheless, the rapprochement remains a long-term fact. Does all this constitute progress? Yes, it does in a modest sort of way. I don't believe that history can get anywhere as a serious subject so long as it cuts itself off on various pretexts from other disciplines which investigate the transformation of life on Earth or the evolution of our ancestors up to the arbitrary point when they begin to leave behind certain sorts of records which historians regard as their own. Or for that matter, if it cuts itself off from the structure and function of ecosystems and of groups of social animals of whom the human race, Homo sapiens, is a particular species. We are all agreed that this doesn't, that this cannot and ought not to exhaust the scope of history. But insofar as the tendency of historical work over the past generations has brought these other disciplines into closer relations with history, it has made possible a better understanding of what has made man what he is today. We understand more of this than Ranke did, and more of it than Lord Acton did. Of course, it's easy to find reasons why history should cut itself off from other disciplines, but they amount to leaving the central job of the historian, which is a job of studying the evolution of human societies, to somebody else. Using the failure of economists or somebody else to do this, an excuse for not bothering them. I've already said that this cannot exhaust the activities of historians. It should also be obvious that history cannot be completely identified with or subsumed under the heading of some other discipline projected back into the past. For instance, historical sociology, or even, to take a recently fashionable title, social biology. History is and must be sui generis, and in this respect, the old historical reactionaries were correct and are correct. Now, this is partly for trivial reasons. Many historians and more historical readers happen to take a vivid interest in the fortune of individual human beings or of human populations, which, say, an animal ecologist would not think it worth writing learned papers about. It would be possible for an animal ecologist or a student of animal behavior like late Conrad Lawrence to write a personal biography of one of his geese. That is, just as it is possible for us to write a personal biography of a particularly prominent individual or a less prominent individual. The fact is, historians do these things because a lot of them are interested in it and their readers are interested, whereas animal ecologists are not interested in the individual goose, but are interested in, as it were, the general behavior of geese in certain circumstances. But there are also less trivial reasons why historians cannot simply practice things the way in which other social sciences do. Whether or not we think the preoccupation with the difference between, say, Gonzales and Aznar will turn out to be trivial when seen in future, we cannot write about animals in the same way that we write about the difference between Gonzales and Aznar. Because if we write about animals that way, supposing we were an animal ecologist who wanted to take an interest, say, in the individual geese, we could not write about them in the same way unless we made them like humans, and they are not like humans. Human beings, as the sociobiologists need reminding, are different from animals as well as they are a particular kind of animal. They make their own world, they make their own history, they speak a language, they use concepts, and they operate through consciousness. And this is a thing which historians have to deal with, and a great many other scientists do not have to deal with, and indeed cannot deal with, unless it turns out that the differences between human beings and some animals are less great than has hitherto been supposed. Now, evidently, this doesn't mean that we are free to do so, that men make their own history as they choose. Even dictators cannot do this. It doesn't mean that history can be understood by investigating man's intentions. One of the main things we have learnt from Marx, as well as from others, is that the results of a multiplicity of intentions are not what people wanted to happen. They're something else. But what it does mean is that the transformations of human activity are mediated by a number of phenomena which are specifically human. Let's call it culture rather than, you know, something else. And they operate through a number of institutions and practices which are at least in part conscious constructs. I hope to deal with this problem a bit more tomorrow. For instance, through governance and through policies. We can both construct and move about the furniture of human life among them, even though not necessarily move out of the house which has been constructed for us by history. To what extent we can move it about is a major historical question, which I cannot answer. But still, since we have language, we have always have and express ideas about ourselves and our activities. Now, this capacity to change by conscious action simply cannot be overlooked by historians. Take the case, for instance, of East and West Germany. Before 1946-45, East and West Germany are part of one country. Nobody would have dreamed making any special distinction between the two. They then had 40 years of different political development, which was done for political reasons. Decision on one side or the other, that these should be two different states constructed differently with different economies. And after 40 years, they had developed in a different way. They were still, for certain purposes, Germans and regarded themselves. But as you can see, the mere fact of reuniting them after 40 years of deliberate action by human, so to speak, decisions, is such that they are now not the same as they were before. This is a phenomenon which historians cannot overlook, and they cannot overlook it. This is not necessarily a trivial phenomenon. It may, if you take the unit of history as millennia, it may be relatively unimportant. But even if you take the unit of history as a century, it will be important. And so, to this extent, history cannot be entirely identified with some kind of social science. Now, note that I am not saying that it couldn't have happened otherwise. The problem of historical inevitability or historical determinism is a completely different problem. I don't propose to enter it here. The question of the role of consciousness and culture, or if you like, in Marxist terms, the question of base and superstructure, has often been confused by getting mixed up with the problem of historical inevitability and historical determinism. The two are not the same problem, and I'm not at the moment considering the problem of historic inevitability, whether one accepts it or not. What I am saying is that history cannot leave out culture and purposive action within man-made institutions. And this is why, of course, Marxism is much the best approach to history, because it is much more clearly aware than other approaches what human beings can do as subjects and makers of history, as well as what, as objects of history, they can't do. And incidentally, because Marx was the virtual inventor of the sociology of knowledge, namely, he evolved a theory about how the ideas of historians themselves are likely affected by their historic situation and their social being. So this is a very much more sophisticated way of approaching this set of problems than the others. But let me return to the main question. Yes, there has been progress of history over the past three or four generations at least, mainly by the convergence of the history and the social science. But it has been modest and the process may, for the time being, be in trouble. In the first place, major advances were certainly achieved by a necessary simplification, which, now that the advance has been achieved, reveals certain drawbacks. For instance, that is why, whereas the Annales school deliberately rejected any political history in order to be able to generalize about the general development of societies, sooner or later it became necessary to reintroduce this element of political history. No doubt, as Jacques Le Goff said, by borrowing the method, spirit, and theoretical approach of the very social science which had pushed it into the background. Nevertheless, it has to return. Secondly, with the enormous development of the social sciences, not least as a group of academic vested interests, the convergence of history with them is now producing divergence and fragmentation. We have a so-called new economic history, which is chiefly current economic academic theory projected back into the past. Much the same is true in anthropology, psychoanalysis, structural linguistics, or any other discipline or pseudo-discipline which can help deserving young men and women to make a reputation by setting a new fashion and saying what nobody else has said before. Novelty, a label, sells history among professionals as it helps to sell washing powders among a wider public. And with the enormous growth of the academic industry, with its special fields and special journals, there is a tendency both to fragment and to introduce, shall we say, irrelevant professional developments. Now, my objection isn't, of course, to historians borrowing techniques and ideas from other social sciences and integrating the latest development in these sciences into their own work, insofar as it is useful and relevant. It is to distributing the historical cargo into a number of non-communicating separate containers where it's difficult to move it from one container into another container. Because there is no such thing as economic history or social history or anthropological history or psychohistory. There is just history. Human beings do not exist as a series of separate sub-departments. And this is, at the moment, the tendency towards fragmentation and separation is clearly, for technical or professional reasons, strong. Now, this has been strengthened by a third phenomenon: the spectacular expansion of the field of historical studies. This is probably the most striking achievement of the past 20 or 30 years. All history is selection, but we are now much more aware than any previous generation of how narrow the selection in the past has usually been. To mention only a few topics which have recently become specialized fields or sub-disciplines, with their own journals, often with their own societies, which is the scholar's equivalent of membership of the UN for a Caribbean and Pacific island. Once you've got your society and once you've got your journal, you are recognized as having an independent existence. Family history, women's history, the history of childhood, the history of death, sexuality, ritual and symbolism, festivals and carnivals are very much in fashion. History of food and cooking, climate, crime, the physical and characteristics and health of human beings, not to mention the continents and regions, both geographical and social, which were previously unexplored or even undiscovered. They are not all new, but they now form an accepted part of the vast field of historical studies. You can read articles in leading journal about the perception of space in Madagascar, about changes in the distribution of eye color among Frenchmen over the centuries, and far, far more about the hitherto neglected history of common people, of peasants, of workers, and all the rest than ever before. Now, this ecumenism, or if you like, imperialism of historical studies is a good thing. To use Braudel's phrase, history is total, even though the current range is only a selection of those things which happen to interest late 20th century historians. And even though completely total history is completely impossible, because we don't know the things we're not interested in. We cannot see them. It's an even more welcome development insofar as it tends to turn history into what I believe it ought to be, namely the general framework of at least the social sciences. Nevertheless, at the present stage of the game, it does tend to turn major historical journals into something like, we have it in England, it's called an antique supermarket. A huge collection of various kind of antiques. The various part of the contents all come from the past. But beyond that, they don't have very much to do with each other. If you start reading Annales today, you will see that, in effect, all they have in common is that they deal with the past, but the interconnections between these things are not so clear. There is a fourth element, with which I hope to deal tomorrow, which has brought this, or threatens to bring this progress to a stop, and that is the denial of the possibility of rational inquiry and generalization altogether, what we might call, broadly speaking, postmodernism. But that is another matter, some of the problems which I hope to look at tomorrow. Well, where do we go from here? I can't predict future developments, particularly because they arise out of the changes in the questions we ask, and we don't know what the new questions are going to be. Partly because we cannot predict the models which will guide us, what has been called the paradigms, you see, the way in which we put things together. But also I can't predict, because history is a very immature discipline, which outside specialist fields, even within some of them, there is still no real consensus about what crucial problems there is in some subjects, but not in others. Nevertheless, I think one or two things can be said. First, I think the time is ripe to turn again to the question of history, which is how humanity got from the Paleolithic to the present. And incidentally, why the entire itinerary from hunter-gatherers to modern post-industrial society was only completed in one region of the world and not in generally. Why it is, as it were, an uneven and specialized development rather than a universal development. Although, for instance, the development of agriculture seems to me a very general development of humanity. Once historians recognize that this is a common and central problem which concerns students of medieval coronation rituals as much as students of the origins of the Cold War, then they can contribute to these broad problems within the limits of their specialist interest. There is, I think, one reason why this may be a good moment for reopening the subject. The history of the development of capitalism, for instance, which is an important element in this, has been enormously advanced by contemporary experience. It was the contemporary experience of the Great Depression of the 1930s which drew the attention of historians to what was came to be called the feudal crisis of the 14th and 15th centuries, the way in which the Middle Ages, as it were, the feudal society broke down before doing. Now, it is not impossible that as we are living through a similar period of considerable disturbance in contemporary life, this may once again give historians ideas, sharpen their eyes to aspects of long-term historical development which they previously had not noticed. Secondly, there is the central question of how things fit together. I don't mean by this where the major mechanisms of historical change and transformation are to be found. I mean rather the mode of interaction between different aspects of human life, between, say, economics, politics, family and sexual relations, culture in the wide and the narrow sense, or sensibility. Now, it's patent that in the 19th century, which has been my subject, all this, in a sense, makes sense within the framework of basically construction of a bourgeois capitalist society or a basically liberal kind. But it is still there. Let me turn this into contemporary terms, for instance. We've been living since 1950 through perhaps the most massive and rapid social and cultural transformation yet recorded ever. And few will doubt that this derives from economic and techno-scientific developments. You want to understand it, you've got to begin with technical revolution and with the economy. And yet, all the various aspects of what is happening in the world since then form a syndrome. But what exactly is the relation of this process to the various things which have been happening? To the decline of the peasantry outside parts of Africa and Asia? To the crisis in the Roman Catholic Church? To the rise of rock and roll? To the crisis in the international communist movement and the collapse of the Soviet Union, to the crisis in Western marriage and family patterns, the bankruptcy of the avant-garde arts, the scientists' interest in the historical development of the universe. I'm mentioning things, all of which are characteristic of the period of our own lifetime. And it seems to me that an important historical problem is to see, in a sense, how all these are connected both with the original, the basic dynamics, the basic dynamo, the engine of historic development, which at least in the past 40 years is without any question the economic and technological one, and with each other. Such questions are enormously interesting and quite enormously difficult. And yet historians must try their hand at them again. They will get further than Montesquieu did, who and 18th century people were trying to solve these problems. They ought to get further than Marx did, because we are further along. Now, there is a third set of problems, closer to the traditional interest of historians. What difference does the specificity of historical experience, events, or situations make? Or not make. Now this can include relatively trivial questions about such things as the role of some individual or some individual decisions, such as what would have happened if Lenin had not managed to get back to Russia but stayed in Zurich. But they can include much more interesting questions. For instance, why is the intellectual history of Germany and Austria in the 19th century, or England and Scotland in the 18th century, so different, although linguistically and culturally each pair of countries belong together? But it is quite true. the actual pattern of intellectual life in England and Scotland, or in Austria and Germany, are quite different. Austrian economists were much closer to Scandinavian and English economists than they were to German economists, for instance, you see. Scottish 18th century, Scotland in the 18th century was part of the Illustration, the European Illustration. England probably wasn't, not in the same way, not as centrally involved. These are problems which, again, it seems to me, historians can deal with. And this raises questions not so much of research, though it also does, but of methodology. Namely, it raises questions about comparative studies and counterfactual studies. And this is important because history exists as a separate discipline, distinct from other historically minded social sciences, because in it, other things are never equal. In other sciences, including the social sciences, you can, as it were, eliminate the accidentals. And you can say, well now, leaving aside, let us say, the individual geese in ethology, you see, we know that no one goose is exactly the same as another goose. We forget about that because we're only interested in, we eliminate things which are not equal. Now in history you can't do it. It is a science in which other things are never equal. Economists can talk about, you might say, equilibrium and analyze economic equilibrium. But as economic historians, as distinct from economists, have pointed out, the situations which historians are concerned are precisely those in which economies are not in equilibrium. And there is no actual sign that equilibria are being established. So it is not possible to say we study equilibria and leave out the things which interfere with it. We cannot leave them out. That is our problem. Even at the level of the apparently unique and unrepeatable, of Mao Zedong's death, of Lenin's arrival at the Finland station, this is what distinguished history from anecdote and from the sort of truthful narrative about which all we can say is that it's stranger or just as strange as fiction. We have to deal with this, we can have to see how this individual thing fits into more generalized analysis. We haven't gone very far with this as historians. So let me conclude. It's made progress, history, in a zigzag manner, in a slow manner, but genuine progress. In saying this, I'm implying it belongs to those disciplines to which the concept of a progress in knowledge is applicable. Namely, the study of human societies and their historic evolution. We have a subject. And so, now, as in the past, I take my stand with the great and neglected philosopher of history who wrote his remarkable Prolegomena to Universal History 600 odd years ago, Ibn Khaldun, the famous Muslim intellectual, and I remind you of what he wrote. History is the record of human society or world civilization, of the changes that take place in the nature of that society, of revolutions and uprisings by one set of people against another, with the resulting kingdoms and states with their various ranks, of the different activities and occupations of men, whether for gaining their livelihood or in the various sciences and crafts, and in general of all the transformations that society undergoes by its very nature. Of all the transformations that society undergoes by its very nature. And so long as we bear this in mind, it seems to me the possibility of advancing in our understanding of this, though not in a linear manner, remains. That's all I want to say, and so perhaps we can now proceed to questions and discussions. Si hay preguntas, si hay comentarios.